Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the conference. Please note today's call is being recorded. At this time, please welcome Andrew Lysenga.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to everybody who's called in, and thanks for taking the time to join us today. We know you're all very busy, and we gave pretty short notice about these calls, so we really appreciate that you could make it on. This is probably our most ambitious work group call of the four we're holding, both in terms of the complexity of the measures and the number of reviews we're trying to fit into these 2 hours. Because of that time crunch, we'll have to work fairly quickly. So I apologize in advance if it seems like we're rushing you at any point. Just to give a quick overview of the goals of this call, what we're doing today is just a preliminary review of the measures before us. We won't be doing any voting or official evaluations, but we're hoping this will help you think through some of the issues in advance of the in-person meeting next week, and maybe to identify any questions or concerns you have that the developers can answer either today or at the in-person meeting. For those of you who are new to this process, hopefully this will also help you get a little bit more comfortable with both the measures and the process itself. For each of the measures we're reviewing today, we assigned a work group member as a primary reviewer. And while we don't have everyone on the call today, those of you who are on could maybe help us walk through the measure that was assigned to you as it comes up. Just give your overall impressions of the measure, bring up any issues or questions that occurred to you as you read it, and that sort of thing. We've also got some preliminary online evaluations that we'll display on the webinar if you're logged on. We also sent those evaluations out to the work group members shortly before this call. And we can use those as a kind of starting point for discussion as well as a source of some input for those from those who are unable to join us today. We'll probably try to walk through the evaluation criteria for each of the measures, and we can see from the preliminary evaluations that there are some areas where there was more agreement among the work group members and some areas where there was less agreement. And it might make sense for us to try to focus our discussion on those areas where there was disagreement in the initial ratings. Before we get started, why don't we have each of the work group members introduce yourselves? Janet, we can start with you if you don't mind.
Good afternoon. This is Janet Nagamini. I'm a hospitalist at Kaiser Santa Clara. And this is, I believe, my third NQF group. I am a former patient safety officer and quality chief, and I'm currently involved in Society of Hospital Medicine as a board member.
Thanks, Janet. Jason Edelman.
Jason Edelman. I'm the patient safety officer at Montreal Medical Center in the Bronx, New York, and this is my first NQF committee meeting.
Great, thanks. Ed Septimus?
Ed Septimus. My background's infectious diseases. I am a previous medical director of patient safety. I am currently on the Quality Improvement Task Force for the Infectious Diseases Society of America and medical director of infection prevention and epidemiology at HCA, and this is my first NQF committee.
Great, thanks. Mary C. Green.
This is Mary C. Green. I'm a nurse practitioner and a clinical nurse specialist in vascular surgery at Harper Hospital and Detroit Medical Center. And I am a board member of the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel. And this is my first meeting for NQF.
Thanks, Mary. And Richard White?
I'm the MD from UC Davis. I'm chief of the Division of General Medicine, and for 20 years I've been the director of the anticoagulation service here. So my spin is that my major area of interest is the epidemiology of venous thrombosis, and I do a lot of analysis of administrative data that includes a lot of ICD-9 codes and the like in trying to elucidate the epidemiology. I was on the steering committee for the original NQF meeting for the Joint Commission CMS performance measures.
Okay, great. Thank you, Richard. So I guess we can just go ahead and jump into the measures. We're actually going to depart from the agenda a little bit. I know Janet has to drop off the call a little bit earlier, so we were going to start off with the measure we had initially scheduled to go last, number 503, anticoagulation for acute pulmonary embolus patients. Janet, do you want to just sort of walk through that measure with us? We can, again, pull up the preliminary evaluations on the screen here. And it looks like there's a, you know, a good degree, some variation in the ratings from the from our work group members here, and some insufficient ratings, some low, moderate, a couple highs. So.
And Andrew, I'll just mention before Janet starts, this is Helen Burstyn. I'm the Senior VP for Performance Measures. I'm just here as backup for you if you have questions about evaluation criteria or process.
Thank you. Very great. So, Andrew, the format, do you want me to just give a quick overview of the measure itself and then jump into how we voted on it, or how would you like?
That would be great if you want to do that.
Okay. So mine was 503, which looks at anticoag for acute PE, measure submitted by ACEP, and looking at patients who had orders for anticoagulation in the ED. So I'm not going to go through every detail, but some of the staff notes, do you want me to cover those, Andrew, or –
If you think that they're relevant, or if you, you know.
Okay, I do think that they were relevant, and I'll point out why as we walk through. But they pointed out that this measure looks at orders for anticoagulation without reference to administration, and that there isn't data or evidence that looks at decreased mortality of PE due to delayed anticoagulation, or there is one study, but it may or may not be strong evidence. So those are the highlights of the notes going into it. And jumping into number one, the impact. I voted low on this, but as I'm looking back, Helen, I'm glad you're here, because when you look at impact, you know, it certainly is a high-volume, high-risk topic here. But the reason that I put low was because I wasn't able to find strong evidence that having orders in the ED for anticoag would result in reduced mortality. So was I looking at that in the right way, or would you recommend a different approach there on the high-volume, high-risk?
You know, I think that's an excellent point, and I think the way we would look at it is really about evidence for the measure focus. So I think, you know, at the outset, certainly VTE is important, or we wouldn't be doing this. Prophylaxis makes sense, and I guess the only question is, you know, would you need to consider, since particularly in EDs, when something is ordered, it's usually done, should you really also consider the evidence for administered? And I'll also point out that, you know, much of the time we've had measures that have been submitted as ordered, which actually, in fact, are oftentimes recommended by committees to be flipped to administered for exactly that reason.
Right. And so that was my reasoning for saying low, and that might be why we have a range from insufficient to high. And I just wanted to throw that out there for the group and clarify, you know, the final voting on that. So you're saying it would be both the combination of evidence for doing this.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I think it'll somewhat depend on how the committee reflects on that. And if you think the evidence is strong only for ordered, I mean, only for administered over ordered, that's probably something to talk about with the developer. But that probably explains part of the splay in people's votes. It'd be an interesting discussion.
Right, right. And then the same carries over to the next one on the evidence. For number two, the quantity, quality, and consistency of evidence. There were two studies that were referenced. One was the JACC article that looked at the outcomes of patients diagnosed with PE in the ED. They concluded, actually, that the mortality rate in this group was low, 1.1%, which was lower than some of the other studies. The second one was early anticoagulation in chest, looking at specifically patients who received heparin in the ED and their outcomes. But when you look at these two articles, I'm still not convinced that giving heparin in the ED would affect mortality. And then there's issues down the line when we get to other criteria about the timing in the ED. So if your standard is were there orders in the ED, we all know that with throughput issues and challenges, you can be in the ED that's very efficient for 2 to 4 hours or for 12 to 24 hours. So that sort of in the ED piece may be very difficult to operationalize and make conclusions about in terms of quality. For reliability and validity, this is another one that may be interpreted slightly differently. I put insufficient for reliability for the reasons I just mentioned. If you look for orders of heparin in the ED, you're not sure if you're looking in 4 hours or 12 hours or how many hours post actual diagnosis. And so if you have efficient throughput and someone's upstairs, I don't know that they should be dinged for giving heparin at 6 hours, whether they are upstairs or downstairs in the ED. Validity, I put low. And for validity, Helen, could you help me clarify that piece of the criteria?
Yeah, it's really about does the measure actually represent that something that was intended to be measured for performance improvement was done, and that it's important. So I think in this instance, you would need to look towards what they actually put on their form. I mean, it really is driven by what they put down. The lowest level of validity would be face validity, which is oftentimes what we do tend to get. And I don't see a whole lot of detail on the submission form, at least, unless Andrew knows about more about specifically how they looked at validity.
Right.
I don't believe so. But I should mention that we do have the developer on the line today, I believe. Emily Graham is on. Operator, could you open Emily's line?
Emily Graham, your line is open.
Actually, if you could open the line for Jeremiah Shore and Arjun Venkatesh. They're both clinicians with ASEP. They sit on the Quality and Performance Committee, and I think they're on as well, and they could speak to these issues a lot better than I could as a staff.
Great.
All right.
Jay and Arjun are both familiar with our process, so excellent.
Mr. Venkatesh, Mr. Shore, your lines are open as well.
So when we developed the measure, it was largely based on face validity. I think in our reapplication, there are several documents that speak to the validity of the measure. And I'm going to, because the call was low earlier and I thought I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Venkatesh, who can go through the details on those studies.
Okay.
Yeah, hi, it's Arjun Venkatesh here. I think with reference to the studies, and I guess the first thing I should point out was that I know it's challenging when what we're trying to measure is the time of the anticoagulation. But I think that the evidence that actually has been published is probably some of the better evidence that we'll get around this question. And the reason for that is that it would be really challenging to ever have a randomized study that would time anticoagulation, because we could ethically never delay somebody's treatment just to see if they did worse or if the people who got it earlier did better. So I think that to some end, the data that the retrospective study from Mayo that shows a mortality difference between patients who were anticoagulated in the emergency department as having less mortality than those who were anticoagulated later on or who had a delayed therapeutic level of heparin, I think does speak to the fact that there's a pretty meaningful outcome from the measure.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to the validity specifically, I think that, you know, this largely is something that is probably more based on face validity. In the sense that there's what we're trying to measure is just the is this process measure of whether or not anticoagulation was completed, and I think what we really don't have right now completed is I guess we have, you know, testing that's done that shows that obviously that there's a relationship between the orders for anticoagulation we administer, but I think it would be a little more challenging to show, like from what I said before, that, you know, there's an outcome difference from the timing of anticoagulation because the comparison group is very challenging unless you look
right.
at it retrospectively.
That's helpful.
This is Janet. I had a question, though, about this study and a conclusion in the CHEST article about early anticoagulation. When you look at the population of patients who received heparin in the ED, they were younger, they had a higher Wells score, they were less likely to have malignancy and CAD and all the other sort of diagnoses. So I could imagine myself easily looking at the populations that didn't receive heparin in the ED as somewhat different. So the patients in the ED were younger, and it was more straightforward that you were dealing with the diagnosis of PE, as opposed to the other patients who did not receive it, where you're saying, well, wait, there's a downside here. Well, maybe they have something else going on causing shortness of breath like CHF, D-dimer, and so you're holding off on rushing to give heparin in this population because of the risk of bleeding. So that was one question I had, though, about this study. Are we looking at two different populations here and concluding that patients have a better outcome without separating sort of the differences in these two populations?
Agreed. I think the distinction is that, I think it's valuable to just take a second to step back and be clear about this distinction early in the review of the measure, is that we're really talking about people who have a confirmed diagnosis of pulmonary embolism. And so this is, I agree that there's some differences between the populations of people that had earlier and later anticoagulation in that study, but this isn't really, the measure's not designed to measure whether or not people were given anticoagulation empirically with suspected pulmonary embolism. Rather, these are people that have the diagnosis made in the emergency department. And I think that kind of then raises it's a very different decision, which is if you know the patient has a PE, then really the standard of care is anticoagulation for those patients, unless for some reason it may be unsafe or that patient may not be ideal. And I think that that's where a lot of the denominator exclusions written for the measure are meant to address those subgroups of patients. But patients that don't really fall within those groups, I think it's very reasonable to say that when the diagnosis of PE is made in the emergency department, anticoagulation should be initiated then.
Right, and thank you for clarifying. I guess I was just wondering if the outcome is related to early heparin versus their comorbidities.
Okay, sure. A second comment is that study did attempt to do a risk adjustment for that. Obviously, your point is correct. There are differences in the populations, but this is not something that you can randomize, and so that's
right.
The best knowledge
okay.
that we have at this point.
Thank you. Okay. So thank you for that clarification. So those were really the usability and feasibility were the next areas, and because of the challenges with knowing sort of around the timing of heparin being given, I think I rated it low because at the end of the day, sure, we want to make sure that we anticoagulate patients as soon as we know they have a PE, and I completely agree with the value of doing that. And I'm just not sure, though, that this is how we achieve that outcome. And I also want to say that there is more guideline there are more guidelines coming out that look at the risk-benefit ratio of giving heparin sooner rather than later and prophylaxing. So I'm just tempering some of the enthusiasm for giving heparin and doing the right thing and making sure patients are treated with sort of the question of how do we best achieve that and will this measure achieve it. So those are kind of my summary thoughts.
Thanks, Janet. Do any of the other work group members have any thoughts or comments on any of the things that we just talked about?
Yeah, this is Richard White. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
My concern really is that if you're going to provide quality of care, you're going to want to give heparin as soon as there's moderate or high probability of PE. I mean, if you really think the person has a pulmonary embolism and you send them for a CT scan, they can get lost for hours, and you know, the measure of getting it in the ED doesn't really tell me that they were really on top of things and did balance the risks versus the benefits and administered it as soon as they reached this threshold of moderate probability. I mean, most people do fine for days, right? But there are a few where it's really life-threatening. And you've got to move as fast as you can. And just to kind of pick up that they gave it 6 hours later in the ED still, then tell me, in fact, you've lost the ones who died, you know, on the table. So I know that my Canadian colleagues and all, at moderate probability, they give them low molecular weight heparin, and then they send them for the CT scan. Or they even wait until morning to get the CT scan. But, I mean, it just seems to be just a little bit short-sighted to just, you know, it's kind of a easy quality measure. Did they get it in the ED? It doesn't get you into the drama of what these patients really look like. And the need, I think, for high quality, to the minute you think about it, you gotta treat them. Now, you got to do your risk-benefit, but that was my problem. I don't know if it's going to push the quality envelope very far.
And I would add to that, Richard.
Hello?
Hello? Oh, I think we lost her. This is Saul Weingart. I agree with all the comments that have been said so far, and particularly about the fact that the timing is the most critical thing rather than the venue.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't care if it's done in the waiting room. It's more, you know, it's more how to get in. And I don't think there's anything wrong with giving it in the ED, but I think it's a little bit, it's not as critical to quality.
This is Ed Septimus. I interpreted that the diagnosis was made, and that may have been a mistake on my part. I also realize I made a mistake on the scoring card. I'd like to correct the quantity evidence and quality evidence. I really meant to say low. I just noticed that, and I apologize.
No problem. Thanks, Ed.
The irony is you might lose a few of your patients to where they're not even in the measure because they died in the ED. Right? I mean, they died there, so you never got them admitted. So I don't know where they go. But I know it can be, in many hospitals, a fair number of hours between ordering the test and getting it. So anyway, that changes the measure. So I'm not sure we're here to do that. Those are my chief concerns.
Can the measure developer make a comment?
Sure.
So two comments. One is, when the measure was originally developed, it was developed in the scope of a measure set around emergency care, and that's why the measure had to do with patients in the emergency department diagnosed, and it was thought that the appropriate scope of time was within the emergency department. I think there is an important discussion about the whole issue about time, and it does make sense that you would want it within a certain period of time after the diagnosis, but that's why the measure was developed the way it was. And the second comment I would have is that I do not think that in the average hospital in the United States there is a long delay between emergency medicine between the consideration of PE and getting a CT. There's a lot of other work showing that the use of CT in the emergency department is easy and probably overused. And so while that may be true in Canada and is clearly true in inpatient medicine, there's not a long delay in the average EV for getting CT scans. They're quite abundant nowadays. And so the thought about the measure, the reason that we did not make the measure the administration of anticoagulation for patients with a consideration of PE is because it would change the unintended consequences. If you implemented a measure like that, it would clearly push the risk-benefit calculation for clinicians to aggressively do early anticoagulation because they would be afraid of the measure, and there would be a concern about causing more harm than benefit. But as we do think there is a documented gap in the number of patients who are given anticoagulation after being diagnosed with PE in the emergency department, we thought this measure was the way to address it.
Thanks. Any other comments or questions from the work group members?
No, I agree that that unintended consequence is probably real. That's probably one of the reasons we have so many CTs now, you know, people wanting to not miss anything. But in the era of use of various probability tools, et cetera, it's possible that could be built into moderate or high probability. But I understand the difficulties.
Any other thoughts or comments or questions for the developer? So this is Andrew again, and I just ask for the work group members to keep in mind the discussion we're having today and sort of note the issues and concerns that are coming up, and we'll ask you to probably help lead the discussion along at the in-person meeting and to raise these concerns and issues that came up so we can get a little bit broader discussion with the full steering committee at that time. And if there are no other comments or questions or thoughts from the work group members, I think we can move on to the next measure. Did anyone have anything else to add on this one? All right, hearing none.
Hello, it's
yes.
Janet Nagamini.
Hi, Janet.
I got bumped out of the call and couldn't get back in.
Oh, no problem.
Apologize.
Did you have any wrap-up thoughts on that measure? We were just about to move to the next, but we'd love to hear anything you have.
No, I didn't hear what was said. I think I pretty much presented my thoughts on that.
Okay, great. Okay, so we'll go ahead to number 371 then. We had Mark Moot assigned to this measure, but he wasn't able to make the call. He did add a number of comments into the preliminary evaluation spreadsheet, though, and I can maybe try to summarize those a bit. This measure is venous thromboembolism prophylaxis. It assesses the number of patients who received VTE prophylaxis or have documentation why no VTE prophylaxis was given the day of or the day after hospital or admission or surgery end date for surgeries that start the day of or the day after hospital admission. It looks like we had pretty high consensus on the high impact and performance gap. Everybody gave it a high rating. Did anybody have any thoughts about that in particular, the importance criteria? Sounds like, you know, given that we got a pretty high degree of consensus there, we can probably move on to the evidence section, the quality and quantity and consistency of evidence. Again, we got pretty high ratings consistently here. Any thoughts or comments about the evidence?
More studies that look at medical patients and tie in the level of risk with outcomes. There's a big paper that was just published in Annals of Internal Medicine by the American College of Physicians, and their meta-analysis suggested that there's a large number of patients who really are quite low risk, and they provided from the meta-analysis evidence that prophylaxis really doesn't reduce the risk of deep vein thrombosis and only reduces the risk of pulmonary embolism by 30%. And their final recommendation is each doctor must assess the risks versus the benefits in their medical patients. So really, the bottom line is we're going to have to all work really hard, do a lot of research to get a good risk tool to know who is in a low risk, moderate, and high risk. They really advocate against exactly what we do here at UC Davis, which we have an opt-out. The minute they come in the hospital, everybody gets put on prophylaxis, unless they have a contraindication to the prophylaxis or have bleeding risks. And that was specifically one of their conclusions, is that not be done. So now it's going to make us have to go back and develop a risk tool, and then we have to get really good data on what the benefits are, again, in lower risk patients. So
would you give us that reference again?
Yeah, this was... lead author was Lederle, Lederle, Annals of Internal Medicine, November 2011, Volume 155, page 602, and it also included a statement on their new guidelines.
Okay, thanks.
So they've kind of thrown some rocks in the road here that by virtue of, and meta-analyses have all sorts of problems with them, but I think everyone was gliding along thinking that all medical patients should be on prophylaxis. Now we're facing at least this one group that suggests that we need to develop better risk stratification tools and not give prophylaxis to a fairly large number of medical patients because they perceive the risks outweigh the benefits.
And are all the patient populations included in the measure you're talking about?
Well, let's see. So
I was trying to figure out, looking
we're, in this measure, it's, let's take a look at the exact wording. I think it takes all patients coming in the hospital, correct? It's not just medical patients.
Yeah.
I should, at this point, maybe we could bring the developer into the line again. I think we have Ann Watt, operator, if you could open her line. And Ann, if there's anyone else who's joining you on the call, we could open their lines as well.
And Ann, your line is open. And John Bott, your line is open.
Thank you. This is Ann Watt from the Joint Commission, and I have with me Denise Kruzanowski, also from the Joint Commission. We are the developers for this measure, and with all due respect to the Lederle article and Annals, I would also, as you are reviewing it, I would refer you to the Joint Commission's website where we actually have a discussion of the conclusions of that article, and basically, to make a long story short, the authors of that article did not have a complete understanding of this measure. This measure is not saying that every patient who comes into the hospital, although it does include all patients who come into the hospital, that they should be prophylaxed regardless of anything else. It says that they should be prophylaxed in the absence of a reason to not perform prophylaxis, basically. That is a key data element that we look for in this measure and that seemed to have been overlooked in this discussion in this article.
I think they emphasize that you must risk assess. And a lot of us have been avoiding that because of the complexity of the existing risk assessment tools and the lack of any validation that these tools are exactly what you need, and the difficulty of getting all the doctors to then fill out a risk assessment tool. You know, it's onerous, so at least in our hospital, we took the opt-out plan, taking the work out of it, put everyone on it, which is exactly what they say we shouldn't do. So I was speaking more for ourselves at UC Davis. We can't take that opt-out approach, at least according to these guidelines.
Well, you know, Dr. White, this is Ann again from the Joint Commission.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things also that this article doesn't, you know, it assumes that we're talking about pharmaceutical prophylaxis, and this measure also allows for mechanical prophylaxis. And I think that the fact that we look for reasons for not doing it implies a risk assessment.
Oh, it does. No, I agree with you. I would only say, just to show you the bumps in the road, the American College of Physicians group couldn't find any articles that looked at the efficacy of mechanical prophylaxis. The only one they had was compression stockings in patients with stroke, and they say there's really no evidence out there. And if you really look, there is no evidence for, like, pneumatic compression versus nothing. So, yeah, we can give them credit for it, but there's no evidence that it does any good. In the stroke patients, it actually did harm, and the problem there is that they use TEDs that are not well fitted, and they might be on too tight, and there's a lot of problems with that study that looked at that. I guess in summary, I'm just saying that these are all great ideas and we all think it's going to be beneficial. There are some groups that think that the evidence is weak and we need better evidence.
Zan, again, from the Joint Commission comment, and that is to note that stroke patients are excluded specifically from this measure, just as an informational item.
Good point.
Any other thoughts on evidence? Or rather the reliability and validity of this measure from the work group?
This measure is only the placing the patient on prophylaxis, correct?
This is Ann, and yes, that's correct.
So again, in a lot of the studies that have been done for root cause analysis, et cetera, the dose could be incorrect, the timing could be incorrect, doses could be missed. So we're really not picking up on those elements. We're just heading square one down of did they actually start the prophylaxis in
basically on the principle that you have to walk before you can run.
Yeah, right. But in the papers I've seen that have gone back and looked at the patients who got thromboembolic problems, the major problems were, A, they didn't get put on anything. B, they were put on prophylaxis and given it absolutely perfectly, and it didn't work. Three, they missed doses. Four, they used the wrong medicine or the like. So when you go to the group that gets the clots and look backwards, there are all sorts of different subgroups. And, you know, one reason hospitals are going to be kind of upset with this is that in a fair number of cases, you're going to do everything right, and they're still going to get thrombosis.
It looks like the Joint Commission, this is Helen, put forward data that their aggregate performance in the last 5 quarters is 83%. So there's still a 17% performance gap.
That's quite good. Don't you think? I mean, 83% seems to be.
Yeah.
Now, how many hospitals are doing that performance measure? They're like 70?
Ann?
How many?
I'm asking Ann. We'll have to respond. Sorry, I don't know.
I'm sorry. I was just double-checking, and I'm sorry I don't have that number right now. I will certainly have it next week, though.
Great.
Any other thoughts or comments on this? Covered, I believe, viability and validity. Is that correct, that we were just discussing?
Well, it's valid to the sense that they did give the first dose. If the implication is they got adequate prophylaxis during the hospitalization, of course, it's incorrect. But as the measure's written, it seems to be that the data you pull is valid.
I have a note here from Mark Moot, who was not able to make the call. He had sort of made a point of stressing this point. I'll just read his comment here from the sheet. Reliability and validity is in question as related to administration of mechanical methods. Presumption in this measure is that mechanical methods of prophylaxis are adequate, yet administration of prophylaxis is the criterion. Administration of chemoprophylaxis would be based upon documentation, typically within the medication administration record, of drug delivery, not simply orders. It is unclear to me where this administration data would come from for mechanical methods. My assumption is that it would only come from documented orders, which would inherently mean a lower standard than pharmacologic methods would be held to, and in my experience, STDs are poorly adhered to. Put that out for the work groups to consider.
Well, that's a variant of what I said about not getting ongoing prophylaxis. I mean, he's right. you can order them. Whether they get put on is another question. Whether or not they stay on is another question. But we're trying to just see if they take that first step, and if that's what our measure is, then I'm assuming you're looking at the orders. Sometimes they're hard to find, the nursing orders for mechanical, maybe not written by physicians and just automatically put on by the nurses.
This is Ann. Excuse me, just to clarify, this measure does call for medical record review, and part of the review that's required is that the mechanical prophylaxis is in place. We would expect the abstractors to look for more than just orders.
Yeah, this is Ed Septimus. That's exactly how I interpreted it, which, as you can tell, may be problematic.
I think Mark's worry is does it stay on them over time, you know? So cross-sectional view at one point in time doesn't really – he's got some questions about it.
This is Saul Wingard. I hear the concerns about the difference between ordering and consistent application of, but I think that's similar as similar for mechanical prophylaxis as it is for the use of medication, since the timing is often messed up. You can never make sure somebody gave it in the right place at the right time. I mean, from my perspective, ordering mechanical prophylaxis, some documentation that, you know, the order was received and acknowledged is a reasonable bar for this kind of a measure.
Okay, thanks. Any more comments on reliability or validity?
At this point, this is Helen. It might be helpful, Anne, if you have any other additional information to share with the full committee next week on that issue.
This is Jason Adelman. I'm just following up on what Saul just said. The way he presented it would almost, please correct me if I'm wrong, but change the measure just slightly to say that if prophylaxis are ordered or documented, like there are lots of cases where in my institution where mechanical prophylaxis are ordered and maybe even in place, but not necessarily documented. So it might be hard to know that it was actually in place. You see the physician attempted at it. And I'm not sure if what Saul said or if the committee members of the Joint Commission would consider that to be good enough if the doctor ordered it, and we just don't know. There is no documentation one way or the other if it's actually in place.
This is Ann, and I would say that if there is an order and no documentation that it's in place, that case would not pass this measure.
This is Rich White again. I got one other comment, and that is at least for my colleagues who really follow the ACCP guidelines carefully, their wording is, at least in the 2008 guidelines, a little bit murky, but the notion would be really you ought to take anyone who's deemed it moderate or high risk and put them on chemoprophylaxis, and that mechanical should be reserved either as a superfluous second type of prophylaxis or placed in the patients who are at higher risk of bleeding, so that there would be a hierarchy. And maybe, Anne, you can come on in. I don't think there's a hierarchy here. I think that you could take a very high-risk patient and just put them on mechanical prophylaxis, and you'd be deemed to be in compliance with this measure. Is that correct?
That's correct. There is no hierarchy. The only thing that this measure says is if there is a reason for not giving prophylaxis, it's okay not to give it.
Right. I think that would be the major point of discussion next week, whether or not it ought to be evolved into a hierarchy because of the really almost absence of evidence that mechanical prophylaxis by itself is equivalent to chemo or that it's even better than placebo. There's just so little evidence out there that most people would want to push the chemo prophylaxis to a higher level of, that would provide a higher evidence of quality. What's everyone else think?
I agree with that.
It's Septimus. I agree with that also.
I agree as well.
I agree. This is Janet.
Thanks, everyone.
I have one question. This is Mary. I have one question about this. This measure is looking at just a single day, right?
It's looking at the day of or the day after admission or the day of or day after surgery.
So if either mechanical or pharmacologic prophylaxis was done on that day, but no other day, the other days wouldn't count into the measure at all.
You know, this is Ann, and no, that's not the way that this measure is written, but I guess one thing that I would like for you to know is that this measure is part of a measure set, and it's a Joint Commission requirement that anybody who chooses to collect data on this set needs to collect data on all measures. And one of the measures you'll be talking about here in a little bit is I'm not sure what the NQF number is, 0376. That is patients who actually developed a VTE, and then to look and see if they had appropriate prophylaxis. So these, we develop measures so that if you look at them as a whole, it gives you a pretty clear picture.
Okay.
On that note, we do, again, have a pretty good number of measures to go through on this call, so maybe we should move on unless anybody's got any more comments on this issue. All right, so let's quickly talk about usability and feasibility on this measure. A bit of variability in the ratings here. Were there any particular comments about the usability or feasibility of this measure? Does everybody understand what we're asking for in that?
Not really. Can you tell me about usability?
I know this comment a little far out there, but I was just looking at the intent of prophylaxis, and what we want to do, surely, is prevent the preventable. Now, that said, how do we accomplish that? In a dream world, we would do real-time chart reviews rather than retrospective chart reviews to say, 6 months ago, this guy didn't get it, and he died, and your performance is not very good. So I'm just throwing this out there. As we look at the burden of audits retrospectively and the mission of quality and safety, is there a way that we can get to a place where if we're going to audit anyway and extract anyway, can we do it real time? And still see how we're doing and improve outcomes and performance at the same time. So that was my thought about usability on this.
This is Ann from the Joint Commission, and just wanting to point out that there is nothing that says that this measure needs to be, the data need to be collected retrospectively. This one actually lends itself pretty well to prospective or concurrent data collection because it's based on all admissions.
Does anybody do that, Ann?
Sure, yeah. What is real time? But while the patient is still in the hospital, yes, a lot of hospitals have developed data collection processes that go on ongoingly. That's probably not a word, but...
Yeah. That would, I think, help a lot really... more firmly support these measures despite some of the flaws. That was just my only thought as we look at all the parts and the criteria and the objectives. So there's a way that we can promote that more. I think that would be...
Dr. Greg Maynard at UC San Diego is really pushing this with the Society of Hospital Medicine. And they have EPIC at UC San Diego, and they're pulling out all of the data in real time. So as they come into hospital, you can see if they got an order for VT prophylaxis, including mechanical. They pull out contraindications like high INRs, platelet counts, et cetera, and they set up a grid and put everyone in a color, red, yellow, or green. The red ones, they're not on prophylaxis, and you need to go in and check those out. And so they've got an ongoing way of using the electronic medical record to look at all their patients in real time. And that's where we're going to be in 10 years. So I'll be just all part of the electronic medical record. And the nurses, by the way, are having three times a day to say whether or not the pneumatic compression is on the patient. So you can see it in real time.
This is Andrew again. It sounded like there was a little bit of uncertainty about what we're asking for when we're talking about usability and feasibility, so I just thought I'd give a quick explanation of that. With usability, we're looking for the extent to which the intended audiences, for example, consumers, purchasers, providers, or policymakers, can understand the results of the measure and find them useful for decision-making. With feasibility, we're looking for the extent to which the required data are readily available or could be captured without undue burden and can be implemented for performance measurement. I don't know if you had any additional thoughts, Helen.
No, that pretty much sums it up. We are working on usability right now because we realize that's a bit theoretical, and it'll probably move to sort of use and usefulness over time, but for now, that's still current. So basically, is the information usable for both quality improvement? Is it usable for accountability? And how easy is it to collect?
Were there any additional thoughts on those issues? Questions for the developer? Hearing none. I think we can probably move on to the next measure. We got a pretty high level of consensus on the suitability for endorsement. And again, we got to move through a good number of measures here. So let's go ahead and move to measure number 372, which is ICU VT prophylaxis. Richard, I think.
Yeah, that looked. I think we can go through very quickly because it really pretty much covers the same material for. Is 371, except you're in the intensive care unit. They are a very high-risk group of patients. They clearly deserve to be risk-assessed and placed on prophylaxis. I think that the only issues in ICU patients is that they may have a higher percentage judged to be at risk for bleeding, but they're also at higher risk for thrombosis, so it's a very high-risk group. I don't think it's right. The only comment I have on what I was given on the from this material is that it kind of reminds me of the electronic medical record. Almost everything was cut and pasted from 371 and put into 372,
right.
and they didn't have any data on ICUs, even though there's a lot of good ICU data out there. There's a big review by Cook and Grutter on thromboprophylaxis in the ICU that I was looking at, and no reference to that. So I was kind of saddened to see that there wasn't really a lot of specific stuff for the ICU. The one big issue that's really not in 371 and not in 372, I think I'll at least bring up, and maybe people can bring some ideas on at the meeting next week. We picked up a huge gap here at UC Davis of a large percentage of patients coming out of the ICU onto the wards not getting prophylaxis because the house staff aren't allowed to transfer the orders. And that's missing in these two measures. They're not being admitted, not being transferred to the ICU. They're being transferred to the ward after the ICU, and that's when they don't get prophylaxis. Just to point out the gap. So I don't understand why 371 couldn't be rephrased like 372 and on transfer from the ICU to the ward or on admission. That goes back to 371, but I remembered that point looking at 372. that would be something to consider. I don't really think there's a whole lot more to run through.
There's a comment from Lisa Moore specifically, who I don't think is on the call, about her concerns about some of the numerator and denominator definitions of some of these, and also feeling like the VTE prophylaxis in the ICU should be harmonized with VTE-1. I guess the question is, does this need to be a separate measure, or is it really a subset of the first measure? I think what she's asking.
That's a good point. And I agree.
Go ahead.
I just say we brought up the mechanical. There's very little evidence that mechanical works. I would like to bring up that hierarchical issue of creating this hierarchy, particularly in the ICU patients. Many of them are at high risk for bleeding and will only be put on mechanical. But if you're going to really prevent it, you better put them on pharmacologic prophylaxis. And then we need to harmonize with getting them back to the ward.
Well, it was probably for the same reason that you said a lot of the citations are similar in both documents, that she thought that they could be combined.
I see.
This is Anne from the Joint Commission. This is essentially the same measure. It is harmonized, except for it's looking at different patient populations.
I can't speak for Lisa because she's not on the call, but I suspect she's wondering why it's not just the same measure. But we can hear from her at the meeting.
That's a good point. I even said at the beginning, there's not a whole lot to discuss. It's pretty much the same measure.
Any other comments or thoughts from the work group members on this measure?
This is all. I guess the question to put to the developers is the added value, the incremental value of supporting similar measures for the ICU compared to the whole hospital. I think if they have a rationale for that, it would be useful for us to know. I don't think it's, per se unreasonable, but it would just be good to have that made explicit.
This is Anne, and I would say basically it's because, as was previously noted, it's known that ICU patients risk for the development of VTE. And therefore, our expert panel wanted to look at them separately because of the relative degree of risk for the general admission population versus the ICU population. So we can certainly talk more about it at the meeting when our physician expert is going to be present.
You can imagine that there would be disparate results. A hospital might be strong in one and not on the other.
Okay. And I think that's why we separated it out so that could be determined.
Any additional thoughts or comments? Questions for the developer? If not, we can go ahead to 373. This is venous thromboembolism patients with anticoagulant overlap therapy. And Anne, I might actually just ask you to give a quick introduction of this measure, if you don't mind.
I'll defer to Denise, my colleague.
Okay.
This measure is to find the first date that parenteral or IV or subcutaneous anticoagulation therapy and warfarin are administered together on the confirmed VTE patient population.
All right, thanks. And we got a relatively high degree of consensus on the importance of this measure. Any particular comments on that subject?
I think there's some confusion, or there's some lack of consensus on the exact nature of that measure, right, between American Heart and I believe one of the other. One says you have to be in the therapeutic range for 24 hours before you stop the heparin. One says you have to have an INR of over 2, which means you could be there for a couple hours. And that's created a lot of concern out in the real world. People are unclear whether or not you're supposed to get 2 INRs in the therapeutic range for 24 hours or a single one. The way I read it, you just have to get into that therapeutic range before you stop your heparin. Just want to know that confusion is out there.
Were you asking what this measure asks for, Doctor?
Yeah, I believe the measure, when I read it, said you just have to achieve an INR of 2.0.
No, you need to have overlap therapy for 5 days.
Right.
Or discharged with overlap therapy, or an INR of 2.0 for greater than 24 hours.
So you require 2 INR measurements, 24 hours apart, before you can discontinue the heparin.
Yes.
Yeah, I would take, that's not what the real world does, and I don't believe there's any evidence that you need to continue it for 24 hours. And we've done a meta-regression of multiple studies, and you can't find any difference between the outcomes in studies where they stop it after they get to an INR of 2 or they go for 24 hours. I think that really creates an onerous situation to keep someone on it for another 24 hours to get a second INR.
Well, I think the intent is to capture, number one, patients that are going to be discharged home that are not therapeutic yet, so that they are still discharged on overlap therapy.
So if I have a patient and at 8 a.m. I get back their INR and it's 2.1, I still have to continue to give them another day's low molecular weight heparin and get another INR to show that they've been on therapeutic for 24 hours.
No, not if they've had overlap therapy for 5 days.
Then again, you can overlap for 5 days and not even be in the therapeutic range.
Yes, that is true, but but the ACCP guideline and the references feel that you are out of a window of developing a VTE then after your 5 days. Your INR could vary for another 2 weeks, and so you might have to bounce around. If you were to be a high-risk developed patient, then that's the physician's preference.
Well, this gets down to the point that I think the measure is too complex because you got to satisfy all sorts of things at once. You got to be on both therapies, right? You have to have a minimum of 5 days, and then you have to have this therapeutic INR for 24 hours before you can stop it. So you get them all blended into this. It makes it quite confusing and pretty onerous when the only evidence is if you don't give heparin at all and you just use warfarin, you get bad outcomes. That's the only evidence we have. You have to give heparin, but there's been no study of 3 versus 4 versus 5 versus 6 days. There's been no study of 1 INR of 2 or 2 or anything. I mean, the evidence out there is minimal for such a kind of a complex measure. At least it's complex to me.
And this is Janet. I would add that the concern would be the harm of bleeding. Unfortunately, I didn't get around to publishing my study, but I did look at adverse events and bleeding on warfarin and heparin. And for a certain subpopulation, it was predictable that on day 3 of bridge therapy was the day that their bleed occurred, particularly in renal patients and particularly in patients over 75. So with lack of evidence, I do think that this complex measure and requirement needs to be reconsidered.
This is Jason. I'm just looking at the numerator statement, and I don't see the mention of 2 INRs over 2 within 24 hours. I saw it later on in the notes, but I don't actually see it in the numerator statement. Am I missing it?
Well, This is Anne, and the numerator statement is patients who received overlap therapy, and it includes those patients who received warfarin and parenteral anticoagulation for 5 or more days with an INR greater than or equal to 2 prior to discontinuation of the parenteral, or 5 or more days with an INR less than 2 and discharged on overlap therapy, or less than 5 days and discharged on overlap therapy, or with documentation of a reason for discontinuation, or documentation of a reason for no overlap therapy. So all of those or things that I was just talking about, they are part of the numerator statement. They're in the included populations section.
Right, and you didn't mention 2 INRs of greater than 2 within 24 hours and then discontinuing. Like, there's no...
That would be included in the data element definition for... I'm looking here. For overlap therapy, and help me, Denise, here. I'm not seeing.
You know, what I think is also in discussion is that there has been a revision of the manual to include INR, another data element with INR values. So for this version of the manual, we're looking at 5 days INR of greater than 2 or the discharge with overlap therapy.
5 days with at least 1 INR over 2 or the last INR over 2?
INR over 2, yes.
The last.
Hey, that's how I interpret it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I went back and forth on this. I couldn't. One says for 24 hours, and then another place it says INR greater than 2, and I'm confused. I think the whole measure is pretty confusing in a way. It may not be worth all the time needed to figure it all out. What was our outcome? Wasn't it like 98%? Do what your measure. Were you in compliance in 90? What percent are in compliance with this?
79.7%.
Oh, only 79, I see. Do you know which element we're not in compliance with? Was it that they didn't send them home on it, or they hadn't reached an INR of 2, or that they hadn't gotten 5 days?
You know, I don't know that we have performed that analysis, Doctor.
Okay.
Well, any ability to bring any of that to the committee next weekend would be helpful, because it looks like it's also gone up significantly in the last quarter of 2010 to 90%. Again, anything you can bring next week I think would be helpful there.
Sure, thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, doesn't it show on this, yeah, fourth quarter 2010 mean 94%?
Right, 90%, right.
And the 10th percentile was at 90%. Interesting, okay.
We can move on to evidence then, the quantity, quality, or consistency of the evidence. We had a little bit of variability in the ratings here, and although it looks like the comments, there don't seem to be too many concerns. Did anybody have any particular thoughts about that?
So which are we on, reliability?
Quantity, quality, and consistency of the evidence. Move on to reliability and validity if nobody has any comments about that. Sounds like none. Any thoughts about reliability or validity?
I think reliability would be low if you can't understand the measure. You wouldn't keep getting the same result.
Precise specifications is part of that.
Yeah. It just needs. I think it somehow needs to be approved. I know what they're getting at. The worst case scenario is you just put them on Coumadin and you send them out the door, and that's wrong. But it's fine nitpicking at that last moment that you have to be on a certain amount of low molecular difference. May be difficult to document.
Any other thoughts from the other work group members?
No.
All right, well, let's talk about usability and feasibility then.
The usability is from the perspective of the consumer?
Of any end users.
Right.
So consumer, providers, whoever the case may be.
Well, I just thought it was such a confusing measure. I don't know how consumers would interpret all this, let alone doctors. But I think we should have more discussion in person.
Thanks. Any more thoughts?
I had one question for Joint Commission. How hard is it to gather this data? Isn't this pretty onerous? Is this one hard or is this one easy to gather?
This is Ann, and I think that what we have found is that hospitals who are collecting these data get used to collecting the data. There are, there really are not, other than general data elements like admission date, discharge date, you know, ICD codes and those kinds of things, the number of data elements for this measure is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So, you know, they have six things in the medical record.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Ed. I thought this would be a little bit more difficult to collect.
I would, certainly.
We use a question and answer feedback, and so there's always support from a clinical lead here at the Joint Commission to help differentiate questions abstractors may have.
Other thoughts or comments?
Well, this is Ed Septimus, and I'm sorry if I'm new, but it's one of the considerations that I've had on other groups is how easy it is to collect the data, and could it be potentially in the future electronically captured so as to reduce the data burden at the local facilities. Is that a consideration?
Yeah, that would fit squarely under feasibility.
Yeah, and so this is one that is much more difficult to capture. Electronically.
We are here working at the Joint Commission to, this is one of our measures that is going for respecification for electronic collection.
But if you send them out on low molecular weight heparin, you're done. You don't collect anything else. I think when oral anticoagulants, and they're certainly going to play a huge role in venous thrombosis treatment, when they finally get FDA approved, I think we're almost done. They're just going to be put on that and you're home free.
Any general thoughts to wrap up this measure, final impressions or questions for the developer? Okay. Hearing none, I think we can move on to the next one. VTE patients receiving unfractionated heparin with dosages of platelet count monitoring by protocol or nomogram. Ed Septimus, I think we had you as the primary reviewer. Would you mind walking us through that?
Which one was that again? Which number is that?
Number 374, sorry.
I just want to make sure.
Sure.
Yeah, I thought this one was
straightforward in terms of the data and the literature that these, this is a, I thought it was a very straightforward one.
Yeah. And fairly high consensus, at least for the most part, on importance. Anybody have any thoughts on importance?
Well, let me ask Anne. So this is looking to determine if when you dose your heparin, you're using a normogram, correct?
That's correct.
And so it doesn't matter one whit that the normogram doesn't work.
This measure does not address the components of a nomogram. It's assumed, I guess, that the nomogram is appropriate and as established by the hospital.
So it's really a surrogate. And, you know, we've been having problems with our nomograms. So they use ideal body weight, total body weight, percent adjustment based on weight or not. And we just did a review by a pharmacy resident, went back and using the heparin normogram that we, a lot of people use around the country, we were only getting 45% of the patients into the therapeutic range in the first 36 hours. So just to let you know, we do great. We use the normogram, but our patients didn't get into the therapeutic range. Just, I mean, to me, that's the problem with the measure, is it doesn't measure what you want it to measure.
Let me ask you this question. What would happen if you didn't use a nomogram and people didn't weight base it?
Oh, it's probably worse.
I mean, that's how I sort of looked at this, that
yeah.
We've sort of learned how to better dose it. Do we have an ideal nomogram? Maybe not. But
yeah.
To not have a nomogram at all,
yeah.
I think would be below the standard.
No, I hear you. And again, I think with low molecular weight heparin, once you get them on a dose, you don't need a nomogram. And with all the new oral agents, you're just going to put them on a dose. You wouldn't need a nomogram. It's only going to be in a small subgroup to get IV heparin. It's going to be a moderate number.
Shall we move on to evidence? Quantity, quality, or consistency of the evidence? Any thoughts on that in particular?
Well, I'd reiterate, the evidence you can use the normogram is great, but the evidence that you actually anticoagulated the patient is not being measured. So I don't know what you mean by the evidence. Yeah, the evidence is good when you look in and they've got a normogram and they say they're using it. That's excellent, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have the outcome you want.
So what's the measure measuring?
Use of a normogram.
Period. And the platelet counts.
Yeah, and you monitor the platelet count. Doesn't mean that if your platelet count drops that you stop the heparin because you're worried about heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, you at least monitor it. So they're surrogates that you're actually trying to do the best job you can.
Well, this is Ed. I mean, do you have another suggestion?
No, I think if we really were concerned, we'd want, I can't imagine the abstractors having a hard time looking to see if the APTT was in the designated therapeutic range by 24, 36 hours, or 48, whatever you want. That wouldn't be too hard to find. Just finding that they used a normogram, though, doesn't tell you the patient got to the therapeutic range. Again, a lot of this moot, because if you use low molecular weight heparin or the new oral anticoagulants, they don't even measure anything. So you're home free. I don't know if it's worth banging our heads on this that long. Only reason I brought it up is we just got a report last week, and much to our amazement, we're using the normogram, and they're still not getting into the therapeutic range.
But what you're saying is using a normogram on your very first shot, you're not in the normal range. But you know, your time to getting in the normal range and the amount of time you spend, like, super therapeutic, let's say, maybe shorter and more reliable, meaning like you might get there within 24 hours if you use the normogram, maybe not on the first shot, as opposed to giving no guidance at all to interns and physician assistants. Maybe if you give no guidance, they'll get there instead of within 24, within 48 hours, and they'll spend a lot more time with a PTT greater than 200. I don't know that as a fact. I'm just sort of asking, because it's not my area of expertise, if the normogram may not get you there right away, but does it get you there faster?
And is that even being measured on this measure?
Right. No, we're not measuring anything. And I think you raise a good point in the sense that I think it's a very small percentage of patients this is going to apply to.
Right.
Yeah, it's only the ones on IV heparin. Again, all the ones on low molecular weight heparin, you don't even do this. We're just really sad. we thought the normogram was going to do everything and we'd be 100%.
Does anybody have any statistics about what percentage actually get unfractionated heparin compared to low molecular?
Oh, in the hospital?
Yeah.
Well, in our case, if we think the patient's going to be discharged within 3 days, they go on low molecular weight heparin. If they're really sick and we worry about bleeding, we put them on IV heparin. I don't know the percentages. So all the stable patients get a low molecular weight heparin, and all the ones that might need a procedure, you know, look like they're sick, then we give them the IV heparin because we can turn it off or reverse it.
And does it make a difference in academic settings versus a community hospital?
I don't know.
This is Janet. I could say that from my practice and my experience in Kaiser, I would say probably 90% of our patients would be on low molecular weight, but I can try to pull up some more data just locally to get a better sense of that.
And again, being new, I mean, I don't know if we use the 80-20 rule or something like that in these measures, but if it's a small fraction of people compared to low molecular, should we have a measure? I'm asking for my own information.
Yeah, again, this is Dylan. I think that's a very appropriate question to see if the Joint Commission has been using this for a couple of years, if they have any information about who's in and who's out. But I think it would be very useful for the committee next week. I mean, again, I think there's a real concern if a good portion of the population is not included. I don't know that we have a sure and fast 80-20 rule.
Again, I apologize if you've already discussed this before. I'm just trying to learn.
No, I don't think so. I think it's a good question.
All about relevance.
Yep.
Any more comments on this subject? Address reliability and validity then, whether the measure's precisely specified and that reliability and validity have been demonstrated. Any comments or thoughts or questions for the developer on those issues? Hearing none. Usability and feasibility. Any comments about those?
It would seem that, this is Janet, in terms of the feasibility, I think we sort of just covered it in terms of what percent of the population are we talking about that use low molecular weight versus unfractionated heparin. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Thanks.
Well, I rated the usability low because it's not telling us anything except that we're using the normogram. So it's kind of a interpretation of that. I mean, it's easy to measure. I just don't. I don't know if I'll walk away feeling more confident that the patients are being treated right.
And Lisa Morris, who's not on the call today, made a note about that here as well. She said usability and feasibility for these are fine. Still not sure they are connected to quality outcomes. Any final thoughts about this measure? Any questions for the developer? Anne and Denise, do you have you heard some things that you can look into and come back to the in-person meeting?
Absolutely.
All right, great. Right.
And we will.
All right, great.
This is Saul. I think one of the things we should all bear in mind is that nobody's holding a gone to most organizations to use these measures, and the criteria might. I worry about letting the perfect be the enemy of the good, and wonder about whether we ought to make some assessment about whether the use of these measures would drive best practices or would drive improvement and better outcomes, at least in some environments. So I agree with all the points that have been said before, but by the same token, it wasn't long ago when nobody used nomograms, kind of gunning it from the hip, 10,000 a heparin and away we go. I mean from my perspective, all of these proposed measures have a lot of value in terms of driving best practice. Whether they're ideal measures, I think, is a whole other question.
I agree with you 100%.
All right, thanks. I think we can move on to the next measure then. 375, VTE warfarin therapy discharge instructions. Mary,
hey.
If you're still on.
Yep. That's Mary,
Yep.
This measure assesses the number of patients diagnosed with confirmed VTE discharged on warfarin home health, or home hospice with written discharge instructions that address four criteria: compliance issues, dietary advice, follow-up monitoring, and information about the potential for adverse drug reactions and interactions. This is a very interesting measure, I think, partially because there are some background things that go on that we don't have any control over, and that is understanding of the patient. A lot of patient education issues in here. Just because the patient is given something in writing doesn't mean they understand it. So again, what is the outcome going to be? And I don't think that because they've been given this information, that they're necessarily going to prevent the complications, which really is not what this measure is measuring. It's measuring, were they just given the information?
If this is Ed, this reminds me of smoking cessation.
Yes. And I think that more needs to be added to it in the background. I don't know that the measure itself, it will measure whether they got information right in written form or not, but what does that mean? Where does it go from there? So I think there's a lot of literature out there that supports patient education, and it supports people understanding how to provide patient education. Unfortunately, I don't think either the physicians or the nurses who take care of patients and have a clear understanding themselves of what's going on have really good teaching learning theory and have a good understanding about how to impart this information to the patients so it becomes meaningful and changes behavior. So I know that that's more than the measures, but I think those are critical things. If this eventually is going to have a change in outcome, which I think is what our intent is, more has to be done. Just as you say, like the smoking cessation, sure, we tell them, but do they, I can teach you, but did you learn, type of a thing? Or did it make a difference, They still have the choices, even though they have the information, to follow through on it or not. So I think there is a big gap because of our understanding of how patients learn and who the patient is and what the value system is of that patient.
I have a question. If I have a handout and I hand it to my Hmong patient, do I get credit for educating them by handing them in English a written document that describes these four areas, even though they can't read English?
Ann?
Well, I'll add to this. I'll add the issue of medical literacy to this as well. Even if they understand English, they may understand it.
Right.
We leave the method for education. I'm sorry, this is Denise at the Joint Commission. We leave the method of education to the organization. The documentation is what the measure is looking at.
But this is it again. I don't want to be a little kind of contrary to this, but my observation of things like smoking cessation and others is that the facilities put together things so they can meet the measure, and they do very little to look at the effectiveness of what they do. And it seems to me that if we could find a measure that not only looks at whether educated, but whether or not it's effective, would be what we're trying to get at. We can't get that.
I agree.
Yeah, that'd be almost impossible to measure quickly, right? I mean,
well, unless we're looking at readmission for bleeding or, you know, that may be multifactorial. I mean, I realize it's difficult, but I also try to point out that this has limited meaning in some ways, although it's at least something as opposed to nothing.
Well, if the numerator statement has the four components of the discharge instructions, those can be measured. You know, not just a checkoff list that I told them this, but does the patient have, I don't know, the patient went to a different ER with bleeding, I guess that would be kind of hard to follow, but.
Oh, there, I've got two comments. One is that the complexity is going to improve dramatically when the oral anticoagulants are approved, the dabigatran, rivaroxaban, et cetera. But they're still going to have to be given discharge instructions. To me, at least, you got to match what you give them with their language that they can read. Or if they can't read, you got to show them some kind of a video. So I would advocate adding something about matching the language on your instructions and or providing some kind of video. We have videotapes here in 9 languages.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to match that up. But I couldn't see it. I just want to make sure there isn't anything about matching the language. Is that correct?
This is Ann, and yes, it is correct that there is nothing about matching the language. I guess, well, I'll just stop there.
Another issue, I think, in different patient populations is the health belief model of the patient. Oftentimes, I'm in the Detroit area, our patients believe that it's someone else's responsibility to take care of them. So we can give them the information, but their perception is we're giving it to them just to give them the information, not that they're going to assume responsibility for it.
Right.
This is Janet. I am so torn on this one. I agree with everything that's been said so far. Education of patients on warfarin is really challenging. Now, that said, I also feel that you got to start somewhere. And so I really don't know how to weigh in on this because while we do want to make sure that the patient speaks English, if you're educating in English, I'm thinking also about the abstraction burden and complexity that comes with that. So I'm really struggling with how to make this measure operational as well as achieve some sort of standard for what we need to do with warfarin patients. I have studied, as I said, warfarin, heparin, and bleeding within our system. And we have a very robust anticoagulation outpatient and inpatient pharmacy program. And that said, I still see a lot of challenges with our education. So there is a lot to be said about how you educate and making sure that they understand. But I think at minimum, we want to make sure that there were attempts to do it. So mm-hmm. I'm going to have to scratch my head for another week on this, I'm afraid.
So this is a start.
Kind of. If you don't speak English, though, it's not a start. If you give it something in English, you give it a method. Mm-hmm. So why can't we at least add a language match? You haven't taught them a thing if they don't understand.
Then we have to audit that.
Well, we've done it. Well, maybe that's why I feel comfortable. We've done it 9 languages on our table.
And photographs and pictures.
Yeah, we have a video that we show them. So we thought to be in compliance, you needed to match the language. So we just got our interpreters to come in and dub the video in all the different languages. And then
I think you're talking about being in compliance with patient education. That's a different measure.
That could be the patient safety
issue
that we had to be in compliance with.
This comes out of a patient safety goal, but the measure is the documentation of the education, not the material itself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But wouldn't it be easy just to say that you provided whatever education in the patient's language? I mean, that would be all I would suggest. Maybe that'd be too hard to document.
Any additional thoughts on how, in the interest of time, I'll just say, you know, any other aspect of this measure, any of the evaluation criteria, or just general thoughts or comments, concerns?
Well, I think it'll be easy for the abstractors because it's very clear. They just have to be handed, they just have to document that the patient was given material.
It can be verbal education as well, right? It didn't specify that it has to be written.
They have to have record of written instructions home.
Well, I don't think it says that. And also, I think this is based from a patient safety goal that also doesn't say that. Meaning, like, can a nurse on discharging a patient go over, they need to go for a lab test, they should avoid vitamin K, broccoli, let's see.
It says right in the description measure that written discharge instructions that address all 4 criteria.
Wait a second.
And that includes a number of elements, including dietary advice.
Mm-hmm.
Or it says, or other education material. I guess material suggests something that's handed to them.
I would push very hard that it has to be in the language that the patient can read. It just doesn't make any sense to hand them something in English. I mean, it's silly. How can I hand something in English and pass this measure and the person can't read a word of English?
Well, I think we've got some good stuff to discuss at the in-person meeting about this. And I think we can move on to the next measure at this point, which is incidence of potentially preventable VTE. This one, an outcome measure. Number 376, I think we had you as the primary reviewer, Saul.
So I'm not sure I actually realized that until just a few moments ago, so I will do my best, which is fine. I have to go in a few minutes, too, so I'm going to just give you a core dump and then and then run. So this is a measure that, please folks jump in and correct me if I don't get it quite right, but this is kind of a look-back measure. You look at patients who've had a VTE that was not present on admission, and then you look back and see if they had prophylaxis of the kinds that have been described previously. So, you know, on initial blush, I thought, well, yeah, that's a reasonable, that's a reasonable thing. You select this denominator of patients who've had the event and then see whether they got the treatment they needed. There were a number of comments that I made to myself and that, you know, when I looked at the grid, many of you had raised it all, which I think are really quite to the point. One question is, it's not possible to have zero on this. There are going to be treatment failures. That's just inherent in the nature of anticoagulation. So expecting zero performance just doesn't make sense. So the second issue is, should we in some ways think about risk adjusting this? The process or the measure proposers suggest that it's sort of a measure of intent. You can't guarantee the outcome, but simply having having somebody who's had an event who had been appropriately treated versus hadn't, that is sort of a, face, there is some face validity to that. I guess my concern is if you're aggregating up to the hospital level and it turns out that your population is enriched in patients who have orthopedic conditions or are oncology patients, the rate of treatment failure is going to vary, so there may be some problems comparing one institution from another. I think the authors appropriately eliminate present on admission as a criteria, and that's, the problem is it's a little challenging in some cases to ascertain. It makes you wonder if somebody, who presented with it, whose DVT was diagnosed on day two or three, if they might have actually had it when they come in, but nobody got around to picking it up until that time. And what else did I write here? Oh, and then there's this other question about denominator, whether it should be patient or whether it might be appropriate to think about number of days at risk, since that could potentially correct for the period of vulnerability of patients. That said, I don't think it's a terrible measure. I think it is kind of a first cut. I think in terms of the various criteria, is there a rationale for anticoagulation? Yes, there is. There's a good rationale for that. Is there evidence that anticoagulation prevents thrombotic events? Of course there is. Is there evidence that this particular measure distinguishes high and low quality institutions? I'm not sure that that is the case. I think the issues around reliability and validity depend on this ascertainment of present on admission and questions about risk adjustment and case mix that are potentially problematic. Now, I have to run, so I don't get to hear why I'm wrong about all those things, but I just do want to say the next one about the PSIs, I think, are really fraught. There are a bunch of articles that come out that raise problems with PSIs, particularly a post-op venous thromboembolism as a quality measure. It's really great at finding cases, but not great as a quality measure. So I'm sure Jason will have a lot of interesting things to say. So I'm sorry I have to run.
Take care, Sal.
Okay.
This is Ed. The issue of present on admission, most of the facilities are getting pretty good at that, especially because of HACS, healthcare-associated conditions. So I'm not sure that that's going to be a difficult item. Mm-hmm.
This is Janet. The one thing that I did want to add about present on admission is that you could potentially miss the target population that perhaps could have been discharged one or two days ago after surgery, and then they return with a DVT or PE. So it's present on admission, but they were just discharged a few days ago.
Present on admission is more an issue for the next indicator, because this has administrative claims but also has paper record review where the PSI is solely using administrative claims data. I'm not sure if the Joint Commission intended this to be also purely on administrative claims or if it required chart review.
I've got a question for Ann or the Joint Commission. Actually, I got a question about where table 7.03 or 7.04 is. Do I have access to that table to see what codes they used?
I believe it was an attachment to our submission. This is Ann. I believe it was an attachment to our submission materials, but if not, it is available on the Joint Commission's website.
Is it labeled as Appendix A?
Specifications manual, sure.
Is it under Table 703, Appendix A?
Yes.
Okay. So, Ann, let me ask you this. So if you ended up with a catheter-induced thrombus in your axillary vein, does that do we apply the very same criteria to upper extremity and lower, or is there a, in the logic, do you only focus on lower extremity deep vein thrombosis?
No, we're only on PE.
We're looking at phlebitis.
That's a great question. That was exactly my question.
We are looking at phlebitis and thrombophlebitis of deep vessels of lower extremities, femoral vein, deep, phlebitis and thrombophlebitis of iliac veins and venous embolism and thrombosis of deep vessels of proximal lower extremity.
So not upper.
Right.
Okay. All right. So this is really just kind of a root cause analysis of all the patients who have a lower extremity DVT, not pulmonary embolism, though, right?
Yes, PE is included.
Yeah.
PE is included. Okay, so we're just doing a root cause analysis of the people who develop pulmonary embolism or a deep vein thrombosis in the lower extremity during their hospitalization.
Yeah, this is Ann, and I guess, you know, I don't know that you want to talk root cause analysis to somebody from the Joint Commission. I think what you're trying to say is the point of this measure, and this is the point of the measure, is to look at people who actually did develop VTEs during their hospitalization to see if they were appropriately prophylaxed.
Right.
And the point there is then that if a hospital determines that they have a large proportion of those patients, then they need to look at their prophylaxis policies.
Yeah, okay. I didn't have access to that table, so I wasn't sure. If it includes upper, it would be a big mistake because there's no evidence that prophylaxis helps for catheter-induced upper extremity clots, and it would be inappropriate to look at, patients who have superficial phlebitis, et cetera. So I need to get a hold of that table and look at that.
Yeah, well, yeah, we will bring it too, Doctor.
This is Andrew, and I believe it may be in the materials in the folder we sent you. I'm trying to take a look.
Yeah, I didn't see it in that zip file, though. Yeah. I couldn't see Appendix A labeled readily.
Okay. Well,
if you get it, you can even send it to me by email if you want to send it right now.
This is Janet. I had a question again about what about the population that was discharged after a three-day stay, was home for a day, and gets admitted with a VTE condition. Will we capture that population or completely miss them?
This is Ann from the Joint Commission, and that population would not be included in this measure. This is only patients who develop it during the present hospitalization.
Yeah, because I will say I admit a fair amount of patients that were just discharged a day or two ago and then come back with that condition. So I just think that that's an important population that we want to capture.
You know, the problem is it's a very difficult group to capture, to define the population via codes in order to be able to identify them, you know, for the initial data.
Could there be a modifier for how many days they're out of the hospital?
Well, the problem is that when they get readmitted, they're not in this pool to begin with. They don't have a hospital-acquired VTE. They're coming in with a principal diagnosis of DVT, and it's in the principal position with POA is yes. So looking for a hospital, you look for the POA is no. So they're saying they'd have to take all the POA yeses and look back and see when they were last hospitalized and where.
Yeah, but I'm not sure this is possible with this, but I can tell you with healthcare-associated infections, there is time limits put on this. If you come back after having surgery and you come back within a week and you have a surgical site infection, that's a healthcare-associated infection, even though it was present on the readmission. I don't know if that can be done and whether it's the data is solid enough to know how many days you've been out to not be associated with the prior admission.
Catheter-associated urinary tract infection would be the same way.
Yeah, all the HAIs are the same way. But I'm not, this is not necessarily my content expertise, but I don't know if there's any data to tell us, you know, if you get readmitted within 7 days, that's associated with something that happened during the prior hospitalization for DVTs. I don't know.
Sorry to interrupt everyone. This is Andrew again. Just a warning, looks like we're going to run a little bit over. We're going to have a network maintenance being run here at NQF at 6 o'clock, so it's possible we'll have some disruptions to the webinar portion of this, but I don't think that our phone call will be cut off or anything. So just again, a warning for those following on the webinar.
By the way, I think the numerator statement is incorrect, I think unintentionally, but it says patients who received no VT prophylaxis prior to the VT diagnostic test or D. I think what's meant is patients who have confirmed VTE and who received no VT prophylaxis prior to the VT diagnostic test D.
The denominator is patients who develop VTE, and then the numerator is of those patients.
Right, it just doesn't say that.
To measure how many had no prophylaxis.
Right, it just doesn't say that. What you said...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right.
Again, this measure misses the person who did get it, but only every other day or the wrong dose, you know, it's... And drill down to some real exact figures is kind of a yes or no, which may be confusing.
Well, again, in the interest of time, maybe we can move on to the next measure here. The next measure is 0450. Postoperative pulmonary embolism or deep vein thrombosis rate. This is an ARC measure, and I believe we have John Bott on the line if he's stuck around with us this long. Operator, could we open John Bott's line?
John, your line is open.
Hi, John.
Yeah, hi.
So, Jason Adelman, I think we had you as the primary reviewer, if you wouldn't mind just giving us a quick run-through.
Sure. So this is the AHRQ PSI 12. That's a postoperative pulmonary embolism or deep vein thrombosis rate. So on my read, I thought the impact was very high, and the performance gap, in my view, was established. And I think that the PSI tool has been shown to be it's given out free, it's usable, and it's repeatable. If you ran it on the same data set, you'd get the same results. My issue was with the one of my issues was with the validity testing. It showed a positive predictive value. There was two numbers given, I think 50% and around 90%. But I wasn't sure why only a positive predictive value was given and not like a negative predictive value or a sensitivity specificity, meaning like without sensitivity, without knowing how many false negatives there are, we don't really know how many VTs are being picked up. I was wondering if the developers can address that.
That's a good point. I know in the validation studies we did for some measures, there were studies of false positives, and in some measures there weren't. And I'm just assuming if it's not here, this was a measure where that was not studied. I don't have the full context as to why that was. Most of these studies largely occurred before my time at ARC. I do know that when Patrick Romano will be there in person next week, he wanted to, and Andrew's been so kind to allow us to do a bit of updating of the literature. I didn't get that literature from Patrick, but I do know, not to steal his thunder, so to speak, there is some literature in the pipeline where we did some further validation work, and he may be citing that, but you definitely raise a good point.
Yeah, this is Ed. I had the same concern. If there is additional literature, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, I reviewed it, and I know we have a paper in the pipeline right now for publication, and I'm guessing that's one of the several Patrick's going to cite. I didn't have a lot of time to communicate with Patrick this week. I apologize. I just came back from a vacation.
And we'll send out an updated measure once that additional additions are given to us.
Yeah, and we expect to make those revisions by the end of Monday, so but apologies, we don't have it updated at this time.
I can just say that the codes became dramatically better in October of 2009 because new codes were added for upper, superficial, chronic, and so now the remaining codes for acute lower extremity and PE are going to be a lot more specific. So I think the predictive value of the codes is going to be dramatically better, and it just has to do with the fact that the ICD-9 codes are now very, very specific, or more specific. So, yeah, when he presents it, I think it'll reflect the new ICD-9 codes, which is what they use to find the cases.
So the only other thing, that was my main issue, but I thought it affected the usability. It's like clearly understandable and easy to read. It's just been questioned because the validity testing has not been thorough enough. And then to the feasibility, it's just, suspect because it's relates on proper coding. And again, the validity testing should be there. But it sounds like it's, they're presenting more data. So we can review the new data, I guess, by next week. That was it.
Thanks. Any thoughts from the other work group members on any of the evaluation criteria or just general impressions, concerns, or questions for the developer?
We're talking about 450 still?
Yes, 450 still.
I think you meant to say that PE is the third leading cause of post-operative death, not hospital death. Is that correct?
I it's going to take me a while to readily find that, but what question is it? And I'll make a note of it to explore that.
About the incidence of this.
Yeah, I'm not in front of the computer. One of the issues is I printed it off as we submitted it, and for whatever reason, it's not in the same sequence that you're looking at. So I'm just not able to readily find that. I'm sorry.
What?
If you can say the question number, I'll look into it.
Sure. The incidence of PE and the mortality. I think it said that PE was the third leading cause of hospital death, but I believe the data would show that it's the third leading cause of post-operative death. So just
okay.
A small point of clarification.
Okay, we'll look into that before the meeting.
Thanks.
One issue I have is I believe in the software, all it does is it looks to see if you have a major operating room procedure, and then it looks to see if you get a clot, and that's hospital acquired. And some patients are really sick in the hospital for a long time, so you could be in the hospital for 35 days, you get a DVT on day 10 and need surgery on day 40. And I don't understand why, to make it a little bit more accurate and valid, why you don't restrict the day of the operating room procedure to day 0, 1, 2, or 3. In other words, make it the reason they come into hospital. And then because some of these DVTs are occurring before the surgery. And it's really not post-operative. And it'd be pretty easy to change the software. I just would ask next week, you know, what's the rationale for taking patients who have any operating room procedure at any time and then finding a VTE code? Because there's no way to use administrative data. You don't know what day the VTE occurred. So the longer you go with a longer hospitalization, more likely it is the clot came before the surgery.
Yeah, I
just don't know why I would just say you have to have had the operating room procedure early in your hospitalization. You kind of get rid of that problem.
Okay, well, this seems like one of those questions we've fielded numerous times because it does seem very logical. So I'm sure Patrick and Jeff will have a response to that. I doubt it's something we've missed all these years. The measure's been out there for about a decade. So we'll make sure. Thanks for the heads up, and we'll make sure that's answered.
Any more questions or comments? All right. Hearing none, I think we should give a bit of time for public comment. Operator, if you could ask for a public comment at this time.
Ladies and gentlemen of the phone audience, if you do have a question at this time, please signal by pressing star 1 on your phone. We have no registered comments at this time.
Okay, thank you. Well, that just about finishes us up. I guess I'll just reiterate quickly that for the steering committee meeting, we'd appreciate it if you could try to remember some of these issues that we've discussed and bring them up with the larger steering committee and try to guide. We'll probably ask the primary reviewers to, again, do a quick overview of the measure and guide the discussion along at the in-person meeting. And we would ask the rest of the work group members to kind of chip in as well and talk about the things that were raised during this discussion so we can sort of move things along quickly and efficiently at the in-person steering committee meeting. And with that, I think we're all done. Thanks again to everybody for taking the time to call in.
Thank you.
See you next week.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Good weekend.
You
Thank
too.
Thank you.